Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in Philosophy, a channel on the New Books Network. I'm Malcolm Keating, and today we'll be talking to Jan Vesterhoff about Chandrakirti's Introduction to the Middle Way, published by University Press in 2024, as part of the Oxford Guides to Philosophy series. Welcome to New Books in Philosophy, Jan.
Thank you very much, Malcolm, and thank you for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a pleasure. Let's dive in. Your book is, I just said, is a guide to Chandrakirti's Introduction to the Middle Way, or the Madhyamaka Avatara. Can you start with the motivation for writing this guide? Why this person and why this text?
Sure. Well, perhaps I should first explain a little bit that this book is part of a series with Oxford University Press, and the series is called Oxford Guides. And what the series is supposed to do is give students, so it's a series aimed at students, it gives students reading classic philosophical texts some guidance while reading the text, or something to read alongside the text to explain. Most of the volumes in this series cover classical canonical text from the Western tradition, but there is also at least one other non-Western one which has already come out with this Matthew Dusty's commentary on Vatsyayana's commentary on the Nyaya Sutra. So the whole series tries to have a somewhat global coverage. Now, for the specific text I'm covering there, so Chandrakirti's Introduction to the Middle Way, there are various reasons why I wanted to include that specific text. On the one hand, it is really already composed by Chandrakirti as an introductory text. So it is an introduction into one of the key streams of Indian Buddhist philosophy, namely Madhyamaka. And it sets out the discussion in a very nice and systematic way, while also covering quite a lot of ground. So to that extent, it's a fairly good text to become acquainted with Madhyamaka. But in addition to that, this text was also extremely influential in the development of Buddhist philosophy, in particular in the development of Buddhist philosophy in Tibet, because quite a bit of the discussion of the Tibetan philosophical discussion about Madhyamaka can be understood in terms of different interpretations and different reactions to this text. So it has both a systematic component in giving the students a really good overview about basic ideas in Madhyamaka, but it also has an interesting historical component, teaching them about important episodes within the history of the development of Buddhist philosophy.
Wonderful. We'll talk about some of those interpretations, Tibetan interpretations and things as we go along. But first, can we back up and ask how you got interested in Chandrakirti's work? Buddhism is a vast subject area. Why? How did you get to Chandrakirti's text?
Well, my interest in Buddhist philosophy started and is still very much centered around Madhyamaka, which is one of the main schools, or two main schools of Mahayana Buddhist philosophy. And Madhyamaka philosophy proper started with Nagarjuna, usually regarded as the founder of that school, who was a first or second century Indian Buddhist scholar and philosopher. Of course, Nagarjuna himself draws on earlier material, in particular the perfection of wisdom or Paramita sutras. Some of the listeners might be familiar with the Heart Sutra, which is a short version of these texts. And so Nagarjuna is fundamentally trying to spell out the philosophical vision of these Paramita texts, which of course he equates with the philosophical vision of the Buddha himself. Now, amongst interpreters or commentators on Nagarjuna, Chandrakirti has particular prominence. Much of that is, of course, due to his prominence in Tibet. And given that much of what we read in the Western context about Madhyamaka comes via the Tibetan tradition, Chandrakirti features very, very prominently in it. But having said that, Chandrakirti is also systematically a very interesting commentator on Nagarjuna and brings out specific ways of reading his philosophy, which have considerable systematic merit. So it really is a text that is interesting in an all-around manner, both in terms of its significance within the tradition, but also as just a very interesting piece of philosophy.
Yeah, you've mentioned Tibet a few times, so maybe we should talk about that a little bit for the listeners. So when we're thinking about Buddhism, this is a guide to philosophy, looking at sort of canonical texts. Is Indian Buddhism and Tibetan Buddhism, do they have the same canon? How should listeners understand the relationship between what you're calling Tibetan Buddhism and Indian Buddhism, especially when we think about Chandrakirti and his role?
Right. So the Tibetans took it upon themselves to import the whole of Indian Buddhism Indian scholastic Buddhism at the time into Tibet and translate all of the Indian materials they could get hold of into Tibetan and incorporated into their intellectual and philosophical and religious tradition. From the Tibetan perspective, the Indian Buddhism is the role model and the gold standard of philosophical sophistication, which they are trying to develop, which is, of course, not to say that the Tibetans were merely sort of copyists or annotators and so on. I mean, they developed their own ideas and within more than 1,000 history of Buddhist Tibetan philosophical history, they developed very interesting forms of interpretations and ways of reading the Tibetan material, which Indians probably would have found quite intriguing and certainly new. So to that extent, the Tibetan intellectual tradition is very, very firmly rooted within Indian Buddhism, but it builds on that and develops its own take on Buddhist philosophical ideas and its own emphasis in developing these materials.
So Chandrakirti, then, let's go back to him. And you mentioned that he is within the Mahayana tradition, and he is a Madhyamaka. Can you unpack that a little bit for listeners who may not know what Mahayana means, what Madhyamaka means?
Sure. We find one of the main divisions of the Buddhist tradition is into the schools of early Buddhism, sometimes also described as the Shravakayana, and the Mahayana, the so-called great vehicle. The Mahayana is an intellectual and philosophical movement which started probably around the beginning of the Common Era, which has a number of distinctive features, one of which is the prominence of the notion of the bodhisattva, the practitioner who tries to become a fully enlightened Buddha and then also promote the enlightenment of all other beings. Right? So this is a very prominent idea here. And so within this Mahayana form of Buddhism, we find mainly two, which we might describe as intellectual schools or distinct intellectual approaches. One is yoga achara, usually regarded as a form of Buddhist idealism. And the other one, the older one, in fact, is Madhyamaka. So, as I said a minute ago, Madhyamaka goes back to Nagarjuna, first to second century of the Common Era. With Chandrakirti, we are moving here to the seventh century of the Common Era, right? So we have about 500 to 600 years between Nagarjuna, the founder of the school, and then Chandrakirti as a commentator. So quite a bit of scholastic development between those parts as well. What is really, really important for the Madhyamaka school is the central notion of the theory of emptiness. So the Buddha described reality as having three fundamental and universal characteristics, namely everything is existentially unsatisfactory or suffering, everything is impermanent, and everything is without a self. And this notion of the absence of a self or selflessness becomes developed within the Madhyamaka tradition into a universal theory of emptiness, which doesn't just say that persons are empty and insubstantial, but it extends this notion of selflessness or emptiness or insubstantiality to all phenomena, to all dharmas. And this fundamental, all-encompassing theory of emptiness is already prefigured to a certain extent in the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras, in the Pranayaparamita texts. But it then gets philosophically developed, first of all, in Nagarjuna and his works, and then also in later works that comment on Nagarjuna, such as Chandrakirti. So the key notion that is discussed in various ways and form within this text, the introduction of the middle way, really is the notion of emptiness, both when it comes to the emptiness of the self or the emptiness of the person, and also the emptiness of all phenomena.
And so listeners shouldn't think that this idea of emptiness that Nagarjuna and then later Chandrakirti is taking up represents all of Buddhism everywhere, every time there's a particular innovation that's happening? How would you say?
Yeah, I wouldn't perhaps use the term innovation so much insofar as these thinkers themselves wouldn't have considered their own work as innovation. So it's not as in Western philosophy where we think you have, you know, thinkers like, you know, Kant and Wittgenstein who did something completely new and were very clear that they did something completely new and had original ideas and wanted to defend them and portray them to their audiences. Whereas within the Indian scholastic tradition, certainly, what all of these scholars set out to do and thought they were doing was to explicate and explain the original intent of the Buddha's teachings. Yeah? Now, that is not to say, of course, that there is no development within Buddhist thought. But I think what perhaps a better way of thinking about it than in terms of innovation might be in terms of the development of specific ideas that were already present in potential form within the Pali canon, say, or the Buddha's original teachings. So you can imagine that this, like a sort of, if you have a kind of wildflower meadow with lots of different seeds in it, depending on the specific soil, you have different flowers will sprout more strongly or more prominently than others. And I think we can understand quite a bit of Buddhist philosophical development by taking into account that these different schools focused on specific ideas that we all find in the Buddha's own teaching. So they didn't make up new things that they wanted to add there, but it's the emphasis and the development and what takes center stage and what is sort of pushed to the periphery which makes the difference between these different schools.
Right, that's helpful. Thank you. So emptiness is not a new idea, of course. It's mentioned and discussed earlier how Nagarjuna and Chandrakirti emphasize it and talk about it. We might want to say as new, but they would not say that. They would say this is there from the beginning, right? So that kind of leads me to this question about what is different in Chandrakirti and what is familiar. This is a text about philosophy, the guide, that is, right? And so I'm wondering, what are some of the philosophical topics that Chandrakirti takes up that people might recognize, and what is new? So emptiness sounds like a metaphysical discussion. This mention of bodhisattvas might seem a little bit unusual. What How do you think about this question? What's new and what's familiar?
Right. So two very important topics that we find discussed in the introduction to the Middle Way are the emptiness of persons or subjects and the emptiness of phenomena. So when we think about this in the categories of Western philosophical thoughts, we would say, well, one is perhaps the topic within the philosophy of personal identity, and the other one is really in metaphysics. So those are central ideas. I mean, there are lots of other subsidiary topics to do with epistemology and ethics and so on that also come into this, but I think these two claims concerning personal identity and metaphysics are really the key claims. So perhaps let me say just something briefly on both of those. So the notion of selflessness within Buddhism is the idea that there is no fundamentally or ultimately real soul or Atman that travels from life to life, or that even remains constant during one lifetime. Instead, what the person really is a rapidly changing aggregate of causally connected physical things or physical processes and psychological processes, and the kind of stream of these kinds of events. And so part of the introduction of the Middle Way is a development and a defense and explication of this conception of a person against alternative conceptions. So this is one important part. The second important part, which I would classify more under metaphysics, is the theory of emptiness of all phenomena, not just persons, but all phenomena straight altogether. And Chandrakirti has quite an interesting way of setting up this discussion, because he focuses on an examination of causation and argues that, okay, so if things existed in a substantially or fundamentally real manner, then they would stand in specific causal relations with other things. And he distinguishes four different causal relations in which they would stand. Either things would be caused by themselves, or they would be caused by things other than themselves, or they would be caused by both themselves and other things, or they would arise completely without any causes. So he's got these four different positions. And then he does something very interesting. So he wants to, of course, refute each of these four views of causation in order to show that in the end there's nothing left, and we can thereby, by ruling out these four ways in which a substantially real entity could arise, we can also rule out that there are any substantially real entities, because there is no way in which it can arise. And Chandrakirti does something very interesting, because he connects each of these four positions with a specific Indian philosophical school of thought, and arguing that each of these schools endorses one of these views about causation. So he does two things at the same time. So he refutes a specific metaphysical conception, but he also refutes divergent philosophical views. And the discussions that he mentions here are, first of all, the non-Buddhist Samkhya school, which he associates with self-causation. Then the main Buddhist alternative Mahayana school, Yogacara, which gets a very long discussion that's associated with causation from other. And then the final two positions get a somewhat shorter discussion. The third one, causation from itself and others, is associated with Jainism. And the final one, causation without a cause, so to speak, random arising, is associated with the ancient Indian materialists, Charvakas. So Chandrakirti then discusses these all in detail. And this raises interesting questions, both in terms of the history of Indian philosophy, so how accurate was his portrayal of these schools, how to which extent would they themselves regard themselves as refuted by Chandrakirti's arguments, and so on. But it also has, in addition to this kind of polemical or doxographical dimension, this whole discussion also has another dimension, insofar that Chandrakirti also believes that these different misunderstandings of the way causation works are also misunderstandings that the student of Madhyamaka is likely to see himself trapped by or taken in by. So at the same time in which he, say, refutes the Yogacharin or the Samkhyas, he also wants to refute Madhyamikas who hold ideas that are similar to these views. So this is not meant primarily as a polemical work, and it arguably might want to say it's not, even though it looks like a polemical work or a doxographic work in that case, it's not intended that at all, because Chandrakirti actually says in the text itself that this discussion, so the introduction to the Middle Way, is not composed out of desire for debate. Right? So he says, okay, so this is not, the claim is not here to refute other schools. But then, of course, you ask yourself, okay, so what's the point? Why do you refute all these other schools? And the answer presumably is that the Yogacara view or the Samkhya view and so on, they stand in for specific misunderstandings of the way causation could work, which keep you from understanding the notion of emptiness properly. And so by working through these kinds of rival views and seeing their flaws, the student of Madhyamaka can then also advance to a more sophisticated view of what the theory of emptiness actually means.
Right, and I think what you're describing there picks up on something that I didn't ask you about, which is the structure of the text and the relationship with the bodhisattva stages. Because if I'm hearing you right, one thing that seems a little different from how Chandrakirti is laying things out, even though he's doing what a lot of modern philosophers do, think about the conceptual space, identify competing views, and so on, this is all in the service of a goal for practitioners of Buddhism and others who are trying to achieve some sort of soteriological, ethical sort of telos here. Could you speak to that a little bit? Maybe talk about the structure of the text too along the way.
Yes, of course. So another interesting feature of this text is that it is at the same time an introduction to Madhyamaka, but also a mapping out of the entire Buddhist path. And this might be one of the reasons why the Tibetans were so interested in this text, because it also provides you with kind of an outline of the development of the career of a bodhisattva from the beginning up to perfect Buddhahood. And so the kind of structural template that Chandrakirti adopts in order to structure his text is the so-called 10 bodhisattva bhumis or bodhisattva stages, which are described in great detail in a Mahayana sutra called the Dashabhumika Sutra, the sutra on the 10 stages. And Chandrakirti divides his text into these 10 sections, first of all, to connect it with these 10 stages. So the stages, what differentiates the stages are the kind of insight the bodhisattva acquires in these stages, and also their different kinds of abilities in helping beings that are caused by that. Now, what is important to notice also about the text is that its structure is in a way somewhat unbalanced insofar as the length of the treatment of the different stages is very very unequal. So Chandrakirti spends the majority of the text, far more than half, on the sixth stage, the sixth bodhisattva stage, the famous sixth chapter, and basically everything I've been talking about so far is in this sixth chapter. The Sanskrit name of this sixth stage is Abhimukhi, which can be translated as directly facing or directly in front or turned towards or something like that. And what the bodhisattva turns towards at this stage is the realization of emptiness, right? So this is why all this discussion of emptiness and different forms of emptiness and so on is given within this particular stage. And So Chandrakirti lays this all out in this discussion of these 10 stages, with a long sort of long discussion of the sixth stage. And then he finishes it off with a final section, an 11th section, with a discussion of the fully enlightened state of Buddhahood and different properties of the Buddha and the qualities of the enlightened mind and so on. So so to that extent, within the introduction to the middle way, we can follow the entire trajectory of the Bodhisattva from the first stage, with this connected, of course, with a direct insight into emptiness. So this is where it all starts for the Bodhisattva. And then he works his way all the way up to the 10 stages, and then beyond the 10th stage up to the stage of fully enlightened Buddha. Yeah, so it's perfectly right. To that extent, it is quite different from Western philosophical text. It doesn't just start out with, okay, here's the basic idea, this is the argument, but it actually develops a kind of soteriological path of which the philosophy forms a part. Yeah, it might also at this stage be worthwhile to say a little bit about the form of the text itself, because that might not be familiar to the listeners. So like most Indian philosophical texts of this form, the text itself is actually written in verse, which facilitates memorization. Then Chandrakirti wrote his own prose auto-commentary to that text, or composed his own auto-commentary on that text, which explains the material, which is very, very condensed within the verses themselves in a more complete form. Yeah? And so the exposition that I'm giving in this guide is more or less exclusively on the basis of the material that Chandrakirti presents in the verses and the auto-commentary. Yeah? There is, of course, a lot of subsequent discussions on later commentaries on the text and specific works on that text, which, however, form really part of the reception of the text. And given that this is a one-volume student commentary and not a multi-volume project, I'm focusing very much on a sort of an imminent reading of the text, which focuses on Chandrakirti and his own commentary, rather than on what later perspectives on the text might tell us.
Great. Let me pick up on another theme that might be interesting to listeners, and I think is important in this discussion. So so far we've been talking about Chandrakirti's arguments and his views as if there's just a question of whether they're true or false. But of course, there's a distinction between conventional and ultimate truth that is important in the text. And you talk about how we can't know ultimate truth or even express it. It's ineffable for Chandrakirti. So I'm curious, can you unpack a little bit about what this distinction is between conventional and ultimate truth for Chandrakirti? And then how does his view, his claims, how do they fit in here? Is his view not something that is ultimately true? How do we make sense out of that?
Right. Yeah.
If you can.
Yeah, sure. I mean, the distinction between the two truths is one of the most important or widespread hermeneutical devices within Buddhist philosophy. And to put it very briefly, the distinction between the two types of truth is the distinction between the way the world looks to us within the context of everyday reality, that's the conventional truth, and then the way reality looks from the perspective of a fully enlightened Buddha. Yeah. Now, what characterizes conventional truth is that it is the perspective in which we operate and at which the perspective from which pragmatic truth and functionality are important. It is, however, the perspective of beings who are trapped in samsara, in cyclic existence. So it's not the perspective of a fully enlightened Buddha. Huh? And ultimate truth, the view of things in terms of that perspective of a fully enlightened Buddha, is of course the goal that we want to achieve, or the Buddhist practitioner wants to achieve by working through these bodhisattva stages. Now, the how exactly to characterize ultimate truth is, of course, an extremely complex question within Buddhist philosophy, especially given the fact that language and concepts and everything that goes with it is very much located at the level of conventional truth. So the idea to which we can actually get a conceptual framing of something which is beyond conceptual framing is quite complex. And I mean, this brings us, of course, into one of the key problems of interpreting Chandrakirti's Madhyamaka, and that is the question of what precisely he takes to be ultimate truth, or the Buddha's perspective on the world to be, and how that influences also his philosophical methodology. Yeah? So Chandrakirti's Madhyamaka is usually within the Tibetan tradition read as being the main source for the understanding of a form of Madhyamaka, which is called Prasangika Madhyamaka. Now, what exactly characterizes Prasangika and makes it different from different forms of Madhyamaka is a complex issue. But I think in this context here, we can focus on the fact that from a Prasangika Madhyamika perspective, the philosophical aim is not to produce a philosophical theory such that we could then say, okay, so after we've argued for this theory and refuted all objections, we now have a theory that is ultimately true, right? Rather, what the Prasangika Madhyamika is trying to do is saying, okay, so beings who believe in substantially real objects or substantially real selves, of course, have a problem because they are trapped in cyclic existence because of these mistaken beliefs. So what the Madhyamaka is doing is, whenever somebody comes up with a theory that seems to imply the existence of a substantially real self, of an Atman, or substantially real phenomena, so things that are not empty, then the Madhyamaka will present him with some arguments that show that these views are actually contradictory. Yeah? And he will then, because contradictions are a bad thing, the opponent will then be forced to give up those views. Yeah? What the Madhyamaka then doesn't do is then produce an alternative theory, right? They take it on a case-by-case basis and try to refute this idea of substantial existence or svabhava in every form in which it arises, without, however, thereby formulating a philosophical theory that is an ultimately true, that can be regarded as ultimately true. Yeah? And I mean, that connects interestingly with another sort of complex exegetical questions connected with this text, which is the question of how reality actually looks like from the Buddha's perspective. And that raises the interesting question, which is then debated quite a bit also within the Tibetan exegetical tradition, to which extent Chandrakirti believes that Buddhas actually have mental states at all, right? Or whether there is nothing that it's like to be from the perspective of a Buddha. This is quite an intriguing conception. I mean, how could we make sense even of the idea that there's nothing that it's like to be a Buddha? Well, the one way in which you could play that is by saying, look, this whole idea of the existence of the Buddha, or the Buddha's activity and the Buddha's teaching and so on, are really projections by the minds of the practitioners or the beings who are still in conventional reality, right? But there is nothing that it's like from the other side. There's nothing that it's like from the perspective of ultimate reality. So to that extent, you can see that the distinction between ultimate reality and conventional reality connects with a lot of different philosophical facets of Madhyamaka. It connects with, obviously, with metaphysical questions. It connects with questions of philosophical methodology. You know, what kind of logic and what kinds of form of reasoning should we actually use and argue for these theories? And it also connects with the question of what the soteriological ideal that we are trying to achieve there actually is. Is it some kind of superior mental state that is completely free from suffering and delusion and so on, but is still a mental state that, you know, has something that it's like to be in that state? Or is it something that is very different and isn't a state at all?
There's quite a lot in there. I'm thinking now about the mention that you had in the introduction of Tarunatha's account of the debate between Majjhimaka and Yogacharan's Chandrakirti and Chandragoman, right? And I'm curious here. Here we have two traditions, two representatives of two traditions that are in opposition, certainly at the level of conventional truth. But I'm wondering, in light of what you've just said, given the goals of Buddhism, sort of Buddhist practitioners, and how we cannot characterize ultimate truth, what you think — this is a little outside of the realm of your book — but what you think Buddhist practitioners, how they understood this debate. So this debate, that all this time that Chandrakirti is engaging in, right, and criticizing Yogacara for these purposes, how were sort of other Buddhist practitioners understanding it? Was this — what was the point of this, if at the end of the day, in some sense, as Tarunatha's account maybe suggests, as you say, it's undecided whether the Majjhimaka or the Yogacharan is sort of victorious. There's something maybe beyond that debate.
That's an interesting question. Of course, one thing to take into account is that Chandrakirti's refutation of Yogacara in this text is perhaps not best to be understood as a sort of a wholesale rejection of that tradition. That would also be very difficult for Chandrakirti to do, because the Yogacara idea is, or the Yogacara thesis, are very explicitly based in important Mahayana sutras, which make these philosophical claims like everything is mind only and so on. Interestingly enough, also the Dashabhumika Sutra itself, which is the very structural model that Chandrakirti uses to structure his own text, makes these kinds of claims. Yeah? So to that extent, Chandrakirti is certainly not saying that Yogacara should be rejected from start to finish, and it's a kind of a heretical interpretation of the Buddhist teaching and so on. What he is concerned with is that Yogacara is considered to be more than it could really be, and namely being the ultimate and final teaching of the Buddha, right? Rather, he regards the Yogacara teaching as something which is useful to specific practitioners in order, so to speak, to get them to the next stage. I mean, this is a fairly familiar trope that we find in Indian doxographies more generally, that when you criticize other theories, you don't say, okay, well, they were all wrong, that needs to be all rejected, but you usually say, okay, well, they are mostly wrong, but there are also some right things about it, and the right things can be regarded at first step to my position, which is the final right position, right? And so Chandrakirti also says, look, when Yogacara has an important point, when the Yogacharans say everything is mind only, what the Buddha meant by that is to reject other generating principles of the world. So, for example, you could imagine that you have an opponent who says, you know, everything in the world is created by a creator god, Ishvara, or something like that. And then the Yogacharan comes in with their principles and says, no, everything is mind created and mind made. And so he can, if successful, then he can refute this this opposing non-Buddhist idea that the world is the product of a creator god. But the important point then, from Chandrakirti's perspective, is not to get stuck on the Yogacara perspective that then says, okay, well, therefore mind is ultimately real, right? No, he says, look, you also have to realize that once you churn Yogacara through the Madhyamaka analytical framework, you also realize that mind isn't substantially real either. That is not, doesn't exist with Svabhava either, right? So from the perspective of Chandrakirti, Yogacara is a kind of a propedeutic or introductory step on the way towards a more sophisticated philosophical understanding of the Buddha's teachings.
And so we wouldn't want to then say, well, maybe the world is in the mind of a god, and as a sort of further step, that would be to endorse a svabhava or a reification or substantial nature. That would be out of bounds as well, I would imagine. Yeah,
that's right. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, good. Okay, so let's go back then in the time that we have to the debate about how to have debates. You mentioned this a little bit, the discussion of svatrantika and prasangika that is picked up in Tibetan doxography later. I'm just curious, in terms of Chandrakirti's goals, you say he's aiming to not have a debate, right? He says this in the outset of the book. But in some sense, how to debate is a major theme in the text. I guess I'm wondering how you're understanding the relationship between the kind of internal debates that we might have with ourselves and the kind of external debates that Buddhists were having at the time with other thinkers. Is there a sense of those external debates and internal debates having the same kind of ethical and soteriological aims that you're really intending to be compassionate towards your debater in some sense, in a right approach to debate, that the right sort of approach to debate or a useful approach to debate would be really to engage in a kind of vitanda, as Nayakas would put it, only criticizing your opponent, and that should be what's happening inside of you. I'm just a little curious about the internal external aspect of this here, because it seems like there's two modes of debate kind of going on.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, first of all, I think when Chandrakirti says, well, this text is not composed out of a desire for debate, I think what he means by that is not that you shouldn't debate philosophical views, but that the point of that is not to then generate unhelpful psychological states that you are trying to get rid of on the bodhisattva path, but only this time now in relation to philosophical debates, and whether you then have attachment to your own view and aversion to the view of another, and then that you've got the same problems that you had before, right? So I think this is the what he means by not out of a desire for debate. I think the question you mentioned there is a fairly complex one. We certainly know that debating and real debating with real opponents was a very, very important thing within the Indian philosophical culture. Certainly, you know, from the time of Chandrakirti onwards for the next centuries, where those debates were also public and also came with fairly high stakes in terms of patronage and royal favors. David Eckel once wrote somewhere and said that the debaters of ancient India were the kind of rock stars and sports idols of ancient India. So I don't know to which extent that is true, but what is certainly true about this characterization is that this was a kind of high stakes business, which was had important practical implications. And to that extent, it was important for each of the schools to be able to defend their own views according to a set of debate rules that would be accepted by all parties, because otherwise you can't have a debate, right? If you don't even agree on the rules. Yeah? So that is one side of the whole debate business. But then there's also a side of the debate business, which is really the debate as part of the intellectual or spiritual practice that is endorsed in these manners. And you can see that also in the later development in Tibet, where debating was and actually still is an essential part of monastic training and examination to study these materials. But it is also regarded as something which plays a role on the spiritual path itself. And the way it does that is insofar as when you are studying these texts and try to figure out what the Madhyamaka is actually saying, what the right interpretation of these teachings are, there are a variety of theoretical options you can take. And some of these might be in the overall picture more satisfactory than another or more true to the overall coherence of the system. And the only way you can figure that out is by pitching these different interpretations against each other in your own mind. Yeah. But then, of course, it's to a certain extent, you know, it's like playing chess against yourself. There's only one winner. But that is not the point. The point is rather to advance your own understanding to a level where you then realize what the most satisfactory way of reading these texts is. Yeah. So to that extent, there is an important connection between these outer forms of debate and the inner forms of debate. However, what makes the whole issue particularly complex within the Madhyamika context is that within these discussions, people then also raise the question of what kind of rules of debate are actually legitimate within or from the Madhyamaka perspective, right? So usually, and I mean, this is quite unusual. We don't have that much in the Western philosophical discussions. Usually when you have discussions between different philosophical views in the Western context, you then don't also have a discussion about what the right rules of logic are for having that debate. I mean, sometimes you do, but not often. Whereas in the Madhyamika case, this becomes very, very prominent because then you're not just debating about the philosophy, you're also debating at the meta level of how you should have a discussion about the philosophy. And it makes the whole discussion particularly complex.
Yeah. Well, I have one last question picking up on this theme of reading. This is a guidebook. And so you're, of course, hoping that people read Chandrakirti's text, not just your guide, but you're also hoping that they'll read your guide. So maybe could you speak a little bit to how you hope students and professors who are interested in Chandrakirti, how they read your work and how they read Chandrakirti, what they might get out of this book, especially if maybe then they're going to go back to Western traditions of philosophy? What might you think that they could get from the book?
Well, yeah, you're perfectly right in saying this book is meant to be a companion volume, right? So it's not to be, you, of course, you can read it on your own. That I think it's probably to that extent self-contained. But of course, the whole point of a guide series is that you read the original text as well, and then use the guide in order to guide your understanding and get some kind of grip on what is said in the text itself, rather than to substitute it for the reading of the original material. So I would definitely recommend for people to study the original text itself. I mean, the text is quite an interesting time actually for Chandrakirti studies at the moment, because until very recently it was assumed that the Sanskrit original of Chandrakirti's verses and the Bhashya were lost. And so all the work that has been done until very recently has been based on the Tibetan translation of these texts. But now, somewhat miraculously, the Sanskrit originals have actually resurfaced, and the verses and the Bhashya are currently being edited. Parts of it have already been published. Parts of the verses have already been published, and also part of the commentary, auto commentary. And so there is a translation of the largest part of the verses, namely the sixth chapter, forthcoming. Which is the first translation of that material, which is actually based directly on the Sanskrit, which is being done currently by Mark Sideritz and Shoryo Katsura. And so this is, I think, is going to be a reference translation really for the bulk of the text for chapter six. So which is presumably people would want to read alongside the text. There are various other good older translations as well, and I mentioned them in the text that readers can go to. Now, in terms of your specific question of what are they going to get out of this, right? I think the text links up with debates or discussions within Western philosophy concerning questions like within metaphysics, and a question of substance, foundationalism, anti-foundationalism on the one hand, and questions about personal identity and the self on the other. So these are two very large themes, and we talked about them already. So to that extent, I think Chandrakirti presents views here that are interesting, unusual in the Western context, and interesting also in their coherence with one another. And so I do hope that people who read this text in a philosophical context, because this is a book which is meant primarily for philosophers, not primarily for Indologists or Tibetologists or Buddhologists. So I would hope that people who read, philosophers who read these texts, will also read them having these systematic debates within the Western philosophical context in mind, and try to understand one in term of the other, or at least try to understand them in a kind of comparative manner.
Great. Thank you. So I appreciate all of your time. I don't want to keep you any longer, but last question, what are you working on right now that this book is, as we speak, about to be published?
Yeah. So I think what is probably particular a particular interest for your readers is another project on this very text by Chandrakirti that I'm currently involved with in the team of four, consisting of Jay Garfield and two Tibetan scholars, Sonam Takcho and Tashi Tsering, and myself. And so we are currently writing a commentary on the text, which is in a way goes far beyond what is covered in this material. It's much longer because it focuses on the reception history of the text, primarily in Tibet. So what we are going to look at there is how commentators from different philosophical schools within Tibet, so Tsongkhapa, Gorampa, Rendawa, Mipham, the Eighth Karmapa, and so on, who all read the text in slightly different ways and often had significant disagreements about what Chandrakirti was actually saying in these verses, how these are to be related and how they are to be related to the larger discussion about Madhyamaka that was happening in Tibet. So I think that would be interesting for readers who then want to see, okay, so where are actually the philosophical consequences of this material, and hopefully that will be laid out in that book, which should be coming out in a couple of years.
Great. Well, we'll look forward to that, and maybe we'll get a chance to talk to you all about it then. Thanks for your time, Jan.
Thank you very much for having me, Malcolm.